Let us turn now to the Scriptures. Over the past weeks and indeed months now in our midweek meetings, we've been looking at the Gospels, taking some rather random texts concerning things that Jesus has said, you may remember. And we looked at a couple of passages from Mark chapter 1 when Jesus began to preach the Gospel and so on. And over the past few weeks, we've been looking at John's Gospel, and in chapter 15, you may remember, we considered verse 13, greater love has no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. And then a few weeks ago, we looked at verses 18 to 25, that whole section where Christ is telling his disciples that the world is going to hate and oppose his people because it first of all hated him. And last Wednesday we looked at verses 22 to 25, recovering some of the things that we had spoken of previously, and we were looking at this rather strange statement from verse 22 to 25, where Jesus says, if he had not come and spoken unto them, they would not have had sin. But now they have no cloak, they have no excuse, they have no covering for their sin. And we were emphasizing while we were looking at these verses, we made some comments about what the Bible teaches concerning sin, and then what it is that Jesus is saying that he has done. He has exposed and revealed the sin. And because he has been rejected in his ministry, those to whom he did speak these words and before whom he performed these signs and wonders, they are really in a worse condition now than they were before he came, because they are now harder. Having seen the evidences, they are now harder in heart. So that's what Jesus was meaning. And we saw how sin has to be exposed and revealed in order to be brought out, in order that it might be confessed and feared and repented of and turned away from. And we saw the two ways, you remember last Wednesday, how it is that God reveals sin. He reveals it, first of all, in the law. The law exposes sin. I had not known sin, says Paul in Romans chapter 7, except the law had said that you will not covet. Paul is saying, I would not have known that to covet someone else's possessions was indeed a sinful thing, except that the law, the 10th commandment, had said, you shall not covet that which doesn't belong to you, basically. And then we saw also the second way that God reveals sin is through Christ, and that Christ fulfills the law, not only in the terms of keeping the commandments and fulfilling the law's commandments and enduring its penalty in his own body on the tree, bearing the curse of sin for us, but also by continuing what the law does in terms of exposing sin. And so that is why a great deal of the teaching of Christ has to do with challenging and indeed combating sin, bringing it out, exposing it, showing it up for what it really is, and in order to deal with it, and in order that people will come to him, flee from sin to him. That's the ideas that we've been looking at over the past couple of weeks or so. Now, I was going to go on to something else, but I want to come back to these verses 22 to 25 again. Not because I particularly want to over-indulge ourselves in this passage, but there are things here that we still have not, I think, fully explored, and it's important, simply because this is a complex statement that Jesus is making. And we began to deal with it last Wednesday when we pointed out what he means when he says that if I had not come, they would not have had sin. He doesn't mean that they would be sinners, but he means that they wouldn't have that particular kind of sin of knowingly rejecting Jesus Christ. So let's come back to these verses once again in John's Gospel chapter 15 at verses 22 and 25. The verses that we're looking at last Wednesday, we're going to look at them again this evening and make further comments about them, because these verses could easily be misunderstood even now, and they could easily be misapplied. And we mustn't misunderstand what Jesus is actually saying. He says, if I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin, but now they have no cloak for their sin. He that hates me hates my Father also. If I had not done among them the works which no other man did, they had not had sin. But now have they both seen and hated both me and my Father. But this comes to pass that the word might be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause. Now Jesus has been speaking of the world. He has been speaking of the world hating his disciples because it hated him first of all. And then he reminds the disciples in verse 23, he that hateth me hateth my Father also. And then in verse 24 he says the same thing, but now have they both seen and hated both me and my Father. So Jesus is reminding us, he's repeating it, he's driving home, the world hates my people because it hates me. The world hates me because of what I said and did. The world hates my Father also because I represent the Father. And then he concludes it in verse 25, that this is the fulfillment of the Old Testament passage that says the word might be fulfilled that is written in their law, they hated me without a cause. And so the Lord is evidently speaking about being hated, his Father being hated, his people being hated, and we began to touch on some of the things that he was meaning last Wednesday, but we still have things to say about what the Lord is saying, because there are certain things that he does not mean. And so how then are we going to come to this passage once again? Well, let's begin again with the world. When he says that if I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin. Now he is speaking, of course, to those to whom he spoke and before whom he performed his signs and his wonders, mainly the Jewish people, but there were some Gentiles who were also brought in, the Syrophoenician woman, the Roman centurion, of whom Jesus said they'd never found so great faith. You remember, we saw it a few weeks ago in the Gospels. He never found so great faith, not in Israel. And he has told the disciples that the world, that their life in the world is going to be very similar to his life in the world, in a sense, insofar as they keep his word and walk in it, they are going to be treated very much the same way as he was in the world. So when he's speaking about they and coming and speaking to them, he is speaking about the world of Judaism of his day and the world of the Gentiles of his day. And basically, he's speaking of the world in every generation. And it wouldn't matter to whom he went with the gospel, whether it was Jews or Gentiles, what generation it was he had visited, the reception would still have been basically the same, because whether we're Jews or Gentiles, we're all under sin, according to the teaching of the Bible. So Jesus here is saying something about the world. And we've got to be clear as to what he is not saying about the world. He is not saying that the world hates every single thing about God, and that the world hates everything concerning the Christian faith and concerning Jesus Christ and his teaching. That's not what Jesus is saying. And if that, in fact, is what Jesus is saying, then that is not true. Because the fact of the matter is that there are many people in the world, and they've got a great deal of admiration, if you like, and they've got a great deal of earnest trying to obey what they regard as a life of morality and so on and so forth. So when Jesus is saying that his people are going to be hated because he is hated and they hate my Father and they hate me, he is not saying they hate every single thing about me. He is saying there are some kinds of teaching that I teach and they don't like that. There are certain signs and wonders, they don't like that. But that doesn't mean to say that the world in which we are to witness as Christians is absolutely, totally against everything that has to do with Christ and with Christianity and with God and with our doctrine of the Trinity. Now, I'm wanting to, as it were, emphasize and bring that home, because the Bible does not teach that, and Jesus never taught that, but tragically some Christians teach that, and it's not true. There are many people who do not embrace the Christian faith, and yet they have a great deal of time for Jesus, and they have a great deal of admiration for many things that Jesus said and did. I've quoted to you a number of occasions that Gandhi, the great Hindu pacifist, who was not at any stage a Christian, but yet Gandhi had a high regard for Jesus Christ. He regarded him as a God-sent man. He regarded him as a guru. In fact, he thought that Jesus probably was the best of all the gurus. And the Sermon on the Mount, as far as Gandhi was concerned, was the greatest teaching of morality that the world had ever known. So Gandhi was one who approved of what Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, for example. And it's the same with Muhammad. The Muslims today, they regard Jesus as a prophet. They believe that Jesus was a God-sent prophet, and that the Christian people have, in fact, twisted the teaching of Jesus. And like the Jews maintain, we have hijacked Jesus, and we have made him into a god, and we have made him in to be something that he never, in fact, claimed to be. Now, that is the way. Muhammad believed a great deal of good things, we might say, concerning Jesus Christ. And the Jewish people, increasingly Jewish rabbis, increasingly are recognizing that Jesus Christ, the one that we call Jesus Christ, they call him Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph and of Mary, that he was a good Jewish rabbi, and that he taught Orthodox Judaism, but Christians have deified him, and they have founded a new religion on him. There are increasingly Jewish rabbis, and I've heard them on debates, and I was quite pleasantly surprised at what one American rabbi was saying about Jesus. He was a good Jew, he said, and insofar as he taught the law of Moses, and he was including the Sermon on the Mount, he says Jesus is right. He says Jesus had insights into what Moses was really saying in the Sermon on the Mount that our rabbis didn't have, and we're glad that Jesus exposed to us the fact that God is not only interested in the outward act, but the mental act and the inward disposition of the heart. Now, I've heard a Jewish rabbi say that. And he says, but Christians have misunderstood Jesus. They have taken him, they have made him into the second person of their Trinity, and especially this renegade Pharisee rabbi Paul, who abandoned the Jewish faith, invented a new religion based upon Jesus as the God-man. And they say that is wrong. But the point that I'm trying to drive home is this. We must be very careful that we do not misrepresent those religions who do not share our faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, because they may well have areas in their teaching where they actually agree with Jesus and where they actually admire the stand that Jesus takes, that Jesus took on things of morality and decency and so on. And not only does the world have a great deal of sympathy with that, with much of what Jesus stood for, but the world generally, and you find this in worldly people who don't profess to believe in any religion, but if you ask them about Jesus, many of them, you will find that they will agree that he was a good man, and that if the world would follow his teaching, then the world would certainly be a much better place than it is today. And many people agree, without agreeing with Jesus, they agree with the things that Jesus said. For example, Richard Dawkins, he says what the world needs more than anything else is more love. Well, we could have told him that. Jesus emphasized that. So Richard Dawkins inadvertently is in fact in agreement with a great deal of the fundamental emphasis that Jesus made on the way that we should treat one another, loving our neighbor as ourselves. And I'm simply emphasizing that, and there are other areas, even the Hindus, indeed, who believe in a kind of morality, because if you live a good life in this world, then you have hope in the reincarnation to be born into better circumstances in the world to come. So even they agree, and that Jesus seemed to be teaching something that has to do with living in a good way rather than a bad way. So it is not true to say that everything that Jesus stands for is hated by everybody in the world, and every religion in the world is dead set against every single thing that Jesus said. And I'm simply saying that because that is the case. And it is quite wrong for Christian people to be emphasizing that the world is absolutely and totally hostile to the things of God, because the world is not. And the world cannot be, for a very simple reason, that the world, according to Paul, the apostle that we were reading in Romans chapter 2, the world knows that the law of God requires certain things, and on every human heart, every single human being has the works of the law written in their hearts. And this is what we were reading in Romans chapter 2, 4, because in verses 14 and 15 in Romans chapter 2, Paul is saying that there are people who don't have the law of God written in the way that the Jews had, but everybody, in a sense, knows what the law requires. Paul is not saying that the law of God in terms of the Ten Commandments is written in everybody's heart. He's not saying that everybody knows the Ten Commandments, for the simple reason that everybody does not know the Ten Commandments. Not everybody knows the Ten Commandments. There are people who have never heard of the Ten Commandments, never heard of Moses, never heard of anything to do with the teaching of the Bible, but yet in their innermost moral constitution, what the law really is requiring is already part of their constitution. And Paul says they are made in the image of God, and therefore they have the works of the law written in their hearts. And not only that, but many people try to live up to that law of God written in their hearts. There are those who try to do good. You will meet hardly anybody in your course of life who deliberately sets out to live an immoral, indecent life. Most people in the world try to make the best of a bad job. Of course, there are people who are dead set against goodness. We know that. We see it every day. But most people have their moral stands, and they say, well, I wouldn't do that. Everybody knows that it's wrong to steal, it's wrong to kill, it's wrong to lie. They may well indulge in these things from time to time, but everybody knows that that is wrong. And deep down, they wish that they wouldn't live like that. People are going around with troubled consciences because they know that what they're doing, they ought not to be doing, and they will hope to do better tomorrow. And they want their children to grow up to be better than they are themselves. And I'm emphasizing that because the law of God permeates every human life. And that law of God is a coercive power. Just as sin is a power in our lives, so the law of God and morality that is summarized in the Ten Commandments, that also is a power in our lives. Whether we are Christian believers or whatever kind of religion or none we live by, everybody knows that there is a moral coercion, the moral word, the moral imperative, in the words of Immanuel Kant, the moral imperative. And there's not a human being has ever lived who has not been aware of that moral imperative at some time or other in their lives, and they try to do the right thing. And this is the kind of thing that we've got to understand. The scripture does not say that the moral law written in our hearts is sufficient to save us. Indeed, it is not sufficient to save us, because the law of the Lord needs to be explained. And salvation doesn't come by you and me keeping the Ten Commandments. Salvation, as we're going to see, comes by faith in Jesus Christ. But the law of God is given, according to the Apostle Paul, to leave men without excuse. Because God is going to judge us. If we have sinned under the written law, then we're going to be judged by that law. If we have sinned without knowing that written law, the law in our hearts is that standard by which God is going to judge us. And so the law is ultimately going to be the ultimate standard by which God is going to judge us, whether we are saved or whether we are lost. The law of God is sufficiently clear and sufficiently cogent to leave us without excuse, to drive us to seek after the deity who has implanted this law in our hearts. And as Paul tells us in Romans chapter 3, when the judgment comes, men will be silenced. Every mouth will be stilled. All who are under the law will be judged by the law, and nobody can argue against it. And when the verdict is given of guilty and condemned, nobody can protest that there is a miscarriage of justice, because we all know that this is right, and we all know that we have violated this holy commandment. And we admire the law, like the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 7. He is speaking in a sense for all men when he says, I know what is right. I, in a sense, admire what is right. I know what is good. I know what I ought to do, but I don't do it. How to perform that which is good, I find not. I know the right, says Medea, you remember in Greek mythology. I know the right, but I don't do it. I do what is not right. And that's you and that's me, whether we're Christians or not. That's the verdict upon every single one of us. Because even the most natural man still approves of a great deal of the things that Jesus actually was articulating. And men approve of it in their religions. Hinduism says, live a good life. Don't do anybody any harm. Don't even hurt a fly. Don't even kill an insect. And be harmless, and in a sense be holy, and in the incarnation you'll be raised to a higher level of perfection. Buddhism is indeed noted for its pacifism. You don't lift a hand against animals. Buddhism is absolutely a pacifistic religion because it knows that you shall not kill. They take it to extremes. But nonetheless, there's a sense in which they're onto something. And you can name any religion you care to mention. And that is why Islam is so hard on what we would regard as crimes. That's why they stone adulterers. They stone those who blaspheme the name of Allah, because they recognize there's something fundamentally, seriously wrong in this life of behavior. And it warrants the death penalty, because they know there's something about the moral commandment that requires that we live by a certain standard. And they approve of it. And Judaism, of course, the one religion that had that revelation of God through Moses, they tried to live the moral law. How do you keep the Sabbath day? The Ten Commandments, the law said, honor the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Well, that's what it says, but what does it mean? How do you do that? They had 365 commandments concerning how to keep the Sabbath day holy, because they were serious about it. They wanted to know, how do you do this? Because they were in dead earnest. So they agreed with a great deal of what Jesus was in fact summarizing and teaching as well. And yet Jesus is saying here that I've come and I have spoken to them and I've performed signs and wonders and they have hated me because of it. Now this means, of course, that they wouldn't have hated him if he had simply spoken about morality. If he had said to these people whom he is speaking about, love your neighbor as yourself, they would have said, amen. They would have agreed with every word that he uttered. If he had told them to keep the Sabbath day and not go beyond a Sabbath day's journey, they would never have hated him, because he was simply saying what they already agreed with. But Jesus comes and he speaks about certain things, and he does certain things, and they hate him for it. Now, when he says here, if I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin, but now they have no cloak for their sin, and so on. He is not saying that he is the cause of their sin. He does not, as it were, originate sin within them. He is not saying that they were sinners before he came. And because he has come, his teaching has brought sin into their life. He doesn't mean that. Neither does he mean that he has caused their hatred. They hated me without a cause. Jesus is disclaiming any responsibility on his part because of their hatred. He says, I am not to blame for their hatred. I did not cause this. So what he is saying is this. He is saying that when he came and exposed their sin, he was stirring up something that was really already there. Enmity to God, sin against God was already there, despite all their efforts and all their agreeing with Moses and the Ten Commandments. Basically, deep down, there was an antagonism to God that you would never have known about them in all their efforts to keep the moral law. You would never have known that in them there was a deep hatred to the God of the Bible. You would never have dreamed it. It took Jesus to bring it out. You would never have known that they were so deep-dyed in sin until they were exposed to a certain kind of teaching that Jesus presented to them right from the beginning of his ministry and right to the very end of his ministry. When before the Sanhedrin, he was still maintaining that he was the Son of God, you remember. That's what I am, he says, right to the end. And you're going to see me coming in the glory one day with all the angels. So from the very beginning, Jesus began to teach and to preach certain things, and he never deviated. And even when he was sentenced to death, he still never deviated from that message or that core of message that he had at the very beginning of his ministry. And that message was what stirred up the sin of those who really were at enmity to the real God, not the God of their religion, or the God of their own imaginations or their own traditions, but the real God of the Bible, the God of Moses. What did Jesus teach that so angered them and so aroused their hatred? What is it about Jesus that makes all the great religions of the world who agree with his morality disagree nonetheless fundamentally with his basic message? They never become Christians. What is it? Well, it is what Jesus said about himself that so arouses antagonism, because he claimed to be a divine person. And that's the rub, you see, that Islam will not accept, that Judaism will not accept, that Hinduism will not accept, that Buddhism will not accept. They don't even say it's necessary to believe in God at all. They do acknowledge that he was a Buddha, an enlightened man, but to claim deity is going beyond the bounds of belief of all these world religions. It's on this point where religion, where the religions of the world and Jesus part company. They agree that to love your neighbor, that's a good thing. Even atheists agree with that. But to claim that Jesus is God, that's what he claimed, you see. And he claimed it in no uncertain terms. He claimed it in terms in which he said, unless you believe, he told these Jews in the 8th chapter of this very gospel, he says, unless you believe that I am he, you're going to perish in your sins. Now these people were people who were very religious. They paid their tithes. They observed their religion with punctilious detail. And here is this man coming down from Nazareth and saying, I am a divine person. And unless you believe that I am the one, you're going to die, and you're going to die lost. Can you imagine? All of their tradition was based on the assumption that they were God's people. And here is a man who is saying to them, not only that he is God's son, but that they are not God's children. You're of your father, the devil. They said, we are the children of Abraham. And Jesus says, yes, you're the children of Abraham. But if you were Abraham's true children, you would believe in me. Because Abraham rejoiced to see my day. He saw it and he was glad. Abraham was looking forward to me. And if you were Abraham's children, you would have welcomed me. You're not God's children. You're the children of the devil, he said to them. Can you just imagine that? Saying to these people who all their lives had sought to obey the law of Moses, saying, you have never kept it. You have violated every single precept of Moses. And furthermore, you belong to your father, the devil. He was a liar from the beginning. He's the father of lies, and you're following lies. That's why they hated him. That's why the worldly people hate him. Not because he said, love one another, but because he said, I'm the second person of the Trinity, and I've come born of a woman. This is what he says in effect. Born of a woman, I've come into the world in order to pay the penalty of your sins. Can you imagine the affront that is to human reason? But that's the message that Jesus preached. If there was anything that Jesus preached over and over again, it was concerning himself. The Sermon on the Mount that Gandhi so loved, do you remember how it closes? Jesus says, in that day, many are going to say to me, He says at the end of the Sermon on the Mount, I am going to be the final judge. That seems to be missed in those who say the Sermon on the Mount's the greatest teacher. What is the greatest teaching on the Sermon on the Mount? Is it that we're to love our neighbors? No, it is that Jesus is our judge. That there's a day coming when we will all appear before him, and he will be the one who will either bring us into heaven or cast us out of it. You see, the Sermon on the Mount emphasizes the deity of Christ. Unless you come to me and walk in my narrow way, you're never going to have life. Those who hear my words and don't do any more about it, they're like foolish people building a house up on a sand. What is the rock, bed, bottom, basis on which we've got to live out the Sermon on the Mount? It is believing in Jesus as to his person. And furthermore, he tells them in John's Gospel, chapter 5, you remember. He says, you people are searching the scriptures. You're reading Moses. But you're not understanding Moses. Moses was speaking about me. He says, the scriptures, Moses, I am the fulfillment of Moses. Moses was only a preparation for me. That's what he said. You see, they thought that Moses had spoken, and nothing was going to be advanced beyond Moses' teaching. Jesus says, yes, that's true. But I'm advancing beyond that. I'm fulfilling Moses, and I'm explaining Moses in a way to you that you've never even begun to understand Moses. And that's what aroused their antagonism. He was undermining the fundamental presuppositions of their false religion. And he was exposing them and showing up where they were wrong. And they could never answer him from the scriptures. You remember how they answered him not a word. They were struck dumb. They couldn't find a text in which they could accuse him of sin or misrepresenting Moses. He seemed to know the Bible in a way that these people had never even begun to understand it. And that's why they hated him. And finally, when they called for his crucifixion, it wasn't because they had misunderstood him. It was because they had perfectly understood him. He is worthy of death. You claim. Jesus in John chapter 10 said, "Why are you seeking to stone me? Why do you want to put me to death?" And they said, "It's not for some good work. It's because of what you're saying. You, a man, are claiming to be equal with God." You see, they got the message loud and clear, all right. And that's why they crucified. It wasn't a misunderstanding of Jesus' teaching that drove them to crucify him. It was a proper understanding. And that is why many people depart from Christianity, not because they misunderstand it, but because they do understand it. And in John chapter 6, you remember when Jesus began to speak to those disciples who were following him on that occasion of the need to eat his flesh and to drink his blood. They followed him no more, not because they were confused about what he was saying, but because he was making the issue so clear. And they followed him no more. And the real anger and the real hatred and the real animosity to God was beginning to show, because Moses all along had been teaching, "God is going to send another prophet like unto me." All the prophets, they never claimed to be the final word. They never said they were. Moses never claimed that. But Jesus did. Moses never claimed deity or any such thing. But Jesus did. And he taught them about themselves. They were the children of the devil. He spoke about himself as God's son, as the fulfillment of Moses. He spoke about the law of God as being something that they were continually, "None of you keeps the law," he says. "Do you not hear the law?" And he began to say, it's not simply a matter of outward observance, it's a matter of inward disposition. And they were content not to commit the acts of thievery or adultery or whatever. But as long as they were allowed to indulge their mental activity in such directions, it wasn't a sin as far as they were concerned. And Jesus says, but that is sinful too. Because God is not only interested in what we do, he's interested in what we think. He's interested in the heart as well as the activity. It's not simply the physical acts, it's the mental acts. And that's why they were so angry, and that is why they hated him so much. Because like those men who brought the woman taken in the very act of adultery, you remember? And they all crept away because they were all exposed for what they really were. They couldn't argue with him. And they crept away in embarrassment, conviction, and shame, and confusion, because he had found them out, you see. Let those among you who are without sin, you cast the first stone. And they knew that he knew what they were like. And they couldn't answer him a word, and they had to slink away, fretting and gnashing their teeth against him. That's the kind of thing. Now, this is the gospel, you see. When Jesus came preaching, he came preaching the gospel of the kingdom. And when he began to preach, his ministry was the same gospel ministry of John the Baptist: repent, because the kingdom of heaven is at hand. And the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, for example, makes it very clear. The gospel, the preaching of the cross of Christ, it's the preaching of the gospel that is the offense. Foolishness to those who are perishing. To the Jew with his religion, he wants more signs and wonders. To the Greek with his rationality, he wants more arguments to convince him. And we preach Christ crucified. That's what Jesus preached. I am come to give my life as a ransom for many. And that was what so offended them. Total dependence upon the works of another. Has Jesus not told them in the opening verses of this very chapter that he is the vine, they are the branches, his disciples? They must remain in the vine, they must stay in the vine, because without me you can do nothing. The world thinks it can earn its way to salvation. The world thinks, whatever religion in the world you care to mention, all the great religions, they all teach different things, but they all teach the same thing. Do the best you can, keep the precepts of the religion, and you'll go into paradise. And Jesus says, no, it's not like that. You don't go to heaven by your own works. You go to heaven by keeping close to me, depending upon me, because without me you can do nothing. Our salvation does not depend upon our morality. It depends upon us clinging to Christ, because none of us ultimately is moral. We are all immoral creatures, every single one of us. But there is an important teaching that Jesus did emphasize, and I know that I must close. But there is an important teaching, and it's very, very relevant, and it has to do with this passage here. When Jesus went teaching, he overturned, as it were, the emphasis that was so common in Judaism and so common in all the religions of the world, and that is that we somehow or other can keep a life of morality intact and still reject the truth of Christianity. Jesus says it's not like that. I am the way, the truth, and the life. He says, I speak the truth to you. He says, everybody who is of the truth hears my voice. And it's not that we, as it were, learn the truth by keeping morality. It is that we keep morality by learning the truth. Where the Christian truth is embraced in the life of an individual or a family or a society, where the Christian truth is embraced, then there is a high level of morality. And where Christian truth is rejected, there is a decline into depravity. In other words, Christian doctrine and Christian living are intimately connected, as a vine is to the branches. We depend upon engrafting into the vine to produce those works and those fruits that are for the glory of God. Without me, you can do nothing. If we reject Christ, then our lives are going to be immoral lives. And our children will be brought up immoral. And their children will be brought up even more godless, atheistic, and immoral. But where Christian truth is imbibed and received and welcomed, then inevitably a life of godly morality is going to be produced. Because men love the morality, but they hate the truth that must undergird all morality. And that is why, wherever you go, where there is a religion that pervades the society, you find that the population of that society and the national life is basically immoral. And let's call a spade a spade. I'm not saying that Christian countries are sinless countries. Not at all. Left to ourselves, we're no different to anybody else. But the truth does make us free, after all, in John's Gospel, chapter 8, verse 32. It is the truth. If you keep my words, if you believe my words and follow after me, you will know the truth. And the truth will make you free. It will make you free from the fear of men, the traditions of men, and the dominion of sin. Have you ever wondered why there is so much immorality increasingly in Australia? It's because there is increasingly less and less Christianity in Australia. And if the present decline continues, there are those who are saying within three generations this country is going to be a disgraceful country, indulging in everything that is worse, at its worst in the ancient world, that was expelled with the coming of Christianity. And there will be a return to a pre-Christian dark age. and those countries, if I may say, that embrace false religions, is it any wonder that they are so immoral? Because they hate the truth, because they love morality of a certain kind that allows them to indulge in secret sin. But Christ will not have it, because it is secret sins that he actually exposes and rips away the covering that our religion of morality seeks to cover up. And that's where the challenge of this is. And that's really what he means. Deep down, the religions of the world, for all their protestations of admiring Jesus, at heart they really hate him. Because there are levels of his teaching that so disturb and disrupt them that either they must change their life or they must silence him. And that's the issue. May God bless his word to us.